but rather post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Over the years I worked with Tina, I was delighted and relieved by her apparent progress. There were no more reports of inappropriate behavior at school. She was doing her homework, going to class, and no longer fighting with other children. Her speech had improved. Most of her problems had been related to the fact that she was so soft-spoken that teachers and even her mother often couldn't hear her well enough to understand her, let alone correct her pronunciation. As she learned to speak up and was spoken to more often, thereby receiving the repeated corrective feedback she needed, she caught up. She had also rapidly become more attentive and less impulsive. So rapidly, in fact, that I didn't even discuss medication with my supervisors after that initial conversation with Dr. Stein. Tina guided our play during our sessions, but I used every opportunity to teach her lessons that would help her feel more confident out in the world and help her behave more appropriately and rationally. We initially learn impulse control and decision-making from those around us, sometimes from explicit lessons, sometimes by example. Tina, however, lived in an environment where neither explicit or implicit lessons were taught. Everyone around her just reacted to what happened to them, and so that's what she did, too. Our meetings offered her the undivided attention she craved, and our games taught her some of the lessons she had missed. For example, when I first began my work with Tina, she hadn't understood the concept of taking turns. She couldn't wait to start things. She acted and reacted without thinking. In the simple games that we played, I modeled more appropriate behavior and repeatedly taught her to pause before doing the first thing that popped into her head. Based on her excellent progress in school, I truly believed I'd helped her. Unfortunately, however, 2 weeks before I left the clinic to start a new job, now 10-year-old Tina was caught performing fellatio on an older boy at school. What I'd taught her, it seemed, was not to change her behavior, but to better hide her sexualized activity and other problems from adults, and to control her impulses in order to avoid getting in trouble. On the surface, she could make others think she was behaving appropriately, but inside, she had not overcome her trauma. I was disappointed and confused upon hearing this news. I had tried so hard, and she had really seemed to be getting better. It was difficult to accept that what seemed to be a positive therapeutic effort had been so hollow. What had happened? Or more importantly, what didn't happen in our work to help change her? I kept thinking about the effects Tina's early childhood trauma and her unstable home life could have had on her brain, and soon I realized that I needed to expand my view of clinical mental health work. The answers to my failed, inefficient treatment for Tina, and to the big questions in child psychiatry, were in how the brain works, how the brain develops, how the brain makes sense of and organizes the world. Not in the brain as it had been caricatured as a rigid, genetically preset system that sometimes requires medication to adjust imbalances, but in the brain in all its complexity. Not in the brain as a seething complex of unconscious resistance and defiance, but in the brain as it evolved to respond to a complex social world. A brain, in short, that had genetic predispositions that were shaped by evolution to be exquisitely sensitive to the people who surrounded it. Tina did learn to better regulate her stress system. Her improved impulse control seemed to be good evidence of this. But Tina's most troubling problems had to do with her distorted and unhealthy sexual behaviors. I realized that some of her symptoms could be fixed by changing her overreactive stress response. Yet that would not erase her memory. I began to think that memory was what I needed to understand before I could do better. So, what is memory really? Most of us think about it in relation to names, faces, phone numbers, but it is much more than that. It is a basic property of biological systems. Memory is the capacity to carry forward in time some element of an experience. Even muscles have memory, as you can see by the changes in them that result from exercise. Most importantly, however, memory is what the brain does, how it composes us, and allows our past to help determine our future. In no small part, memory makes us who we are, and in Tina's case, her memories of sexual abuse were a large part of what stood in her way. Tina's precocious and over-sexualized interactions with males clearly stemmed from her abuse. I began considering memory and how the brain creates associations when two patterns of neural activity occur simultaneously and repetitively. For example, if the neural activity caused by the visual image of a fire truck and that caused by the sound of a siren co-occur repetitively, these once separate neural chains, visual and sound-related neural networks, will create new synaptic connections that become a single interconnected network. Once this new set of connections between visual and auditory networks is created, merely stimulating one part of the network, for example, hearing the siren, can actually activate the visual part of the chain, and the person will almost automatically visualize a fire truck. This powerful property of association is a universal feature of the brain. It is through association that we weave all of our incoming sensory signals together, sound, sight, touch, scent, to create the whole person, place, thing, and action. Association allows and underlies both language and memory. Our conscious memory is full of gaps, of course, which is actually a good thing. Our brains filter out the ordinary and expected, which is utterly necessary to allow us to function. When you drive, for example, you rely automatically on your previous experiences with cars and roads. If you had to focus on every aspect of what your senses are taking in, you'd be overwhelmed and would probably crash. As you learn anything, in fact, your brain is constantly checking current experience against stored templates, essentially memory, of previous similar situations and sensations, asking, "Is this new?" and "Is this something I need to attend to?" So, as you move down the road, your brain's motor vestibular system is telling you that you are in a certain position. But your brain is probably not making new memories about that. Your brain has stored in it previous sitting experiences in cars, and the pattern of neural activity associated with that doesn't need to change. There's nothing new. You've been there, done that. It's familiar. This is also why you can drive over large stretches of familiar highways without remembering almost anything at all that you did during that drive. This is important because all of that previously stored experience has laid down the neural networks, the memory template, that you now use to make sense out of any new incoming information. These templates are formed throughout the brain at many different levels, and because information comes in first to the lower, more primitive areas, many are not even accessible to conscious awareness. For example, young Tina almost certainly wasn't aware of the template that guided her interactions with men and shaped her behavior with me when we first met. Further, all of us have probably had the experience of physically jumping up before we figured out what it was that startled us in the first place. This happens because our brain's stress response systems carry information about potential threats and are primed to respond to them as quickly as possible, which often means before the cortex can consider what action to take. If, like Tina, we have had highly stressful experiences, reminders of those situations can be similarly powerful and provoke reactions that are similarly driven by unconscious processes. What this also means is that early experiences will necessarily have a far greater impact than later ones. The brain tries to make sense of the world by looking for patterns. When it links coherent, consistently connected patterns together again, it tags them as normal or expected and stops paying conscious attention. So, for example, the very first time you were placed in a sitting position as an infant, you did pay attention to the novel sensations emanating from your buttocks. Your brain learned to sense the pressure associated with sitting normally. You began to sense how to balance your weight to sit upright via your motor vestibular system, and eventually you learned to sit. Now when you sit, unless it's uncomfortable or the seat is unusually textured or shaped, or you have some kind of balance disorder, you pay little attention to staying upright or the pressure the seat puts on your rear. When you are driving, it's something you rarely attend to at all. What you do scan the road for is novelty, things that are out of place, such as a truck barreling down the wrong side of the freeway. This is why we offload perceptions of things we consider normal, so that we can rapidly react to things that are aberrant and require immediate attention. Neural systems have evolved to be especially sensitive to novelty, since new experiences usually signal either danger or opportunity. One of the most important characteristics of both memory, neural tissue, and of development, then, is that they all change with patterned, repetitive activity. So the systems in your brain that get repeatedly activated will change, and the systems in your brain that don't get activated won't change. This use-dependent development is one of the most important properties of neural tissue. It seems like a simple concept, but it has enormous and wide-ranging implications. And understanding this concept, I came to believe, was key to understanding children like Tina. She had developed a very unfortunate set of associations because she was sexually abused so early in life. Her first experiences with men and her teenage male abuser were what shaped her conception of what men are and how to act toward them. Early experiences with those around us mold all of our worldviews. Because of the enormous amount of information the brain is confronted with daily, we must use these patterns to predict what the world is like. If early experiences are aberrant, these predictions may guide our behavior in dysfunctional ways. In Tina's world, males larger than she was were frightening, demanding creatures who forced her or her mother into sex. The scent, sight, and sounds associated with them came together to compose a set of memory templates that she used to make sense of the world. And so, when she came into my office that first time and was alone in the company of an adult male, it was perfectly natural for her to assume that sex was what I wanted as well. When she went to school and exposed herself or tried to engage in sex play with other children, she was modeling what she knew about how to behave. She didn't consciously think about it. It was just a set of behaviors that were part of her toxic associations, her twisted template for sexuality. Unfortunately, with only an hour a week of therapy, it was almost impossible to undo that set of associations. I could model the behavior of a different kind of adult male. I could show her that there were situations where sexual activity was inappropriate and help her learn to resist impulses. But I couldn't, in such a small amount of time, replace the template that had been forged in the fresh tissue of her young brain, that had been burned in with patterned, repetitive early experience. I would need to integrate a lot more about how the human brain works, how the brain changes, and the systems that interact in this learning into my treatments before I could even begin to do better for patients like Tina, patients whose lives and memories had been marred in multiple ways by early trauma. Chapter 2. For Your Own Good. I need your help. The caller, Stan Walker, a pseudonym, was an attorney for the Public Guardian's Office in Cook County, Illinois. I had completed my training in child psychiatry and was now an assistant professor at the University of Chicago, still working at the clinic and running my lab. It was 1990. I just inherited a case scheduled to go to trial next week, he told me, explaining that it was a homicide. A 3-year-old girl named Sandy had witnessed the murder of her own mother. Now, almost a year later, the prosecution wanted her to testify about it. I'm concerned that this might be pretty overwhelming for her, Stan went on. asking if I might be able to help prepare her for court. Pretty overwhelming, I thought sarcastically to myself. You think so? Stan was a guardian ad litem, an attorney appointed by the court to represent children in the legal system. In Cook County, where Chicago is located, the public guardian's office has a full-time staff to represent children in the Child Protective Services, CPS, system. In almost all other communities, this role is played by an appointed attorney who may or may not have experience and training in child law. Cook County had created the full-time positions in the noble hope that if attorneys worked their cases full-time, they could develop experience with children, learn about maltreatment, and thus better serve those they represent. Unfortunately, like all other components of the child protective system, the volume of cases was overwhelming, and the office was underfunded. "Who is your therapist?" I asked, thinking that someone familiar to the child would be much better suited to help her prepare. "She doesn't have one," he said. This was disturbing news. "No therapist? Where is she living?" I asked. "We don't really know. She is in foster care, but the prosecutor and the Department of Child and Family Services are keeping her location undisclosed because there have been threats against her life. She knew the suspect and identified him for the police. He is in a gang, and there is a contract out on her." This was sounding worse and worse. "She gave a credible ID at age 3? I asked. I knew that eyewitness testimony is easily challenged in court because of the properties of narrative memory we noted earlier, especially its gaps and the way it tends to fill in the expected. And from a 4-year-old about an event that occurred when she was 3? If the prosecutors didn't have some help, a good defense attorney would easily make Sandy's testimony appear completely unreliable. Well, she knew him, Stan explained. She both spontaneously said he did it and later identified him from a photo array. I asked if there was any additional evidence, thinking that maybe the little girl's testimony wouldn't even be necessary. If there was enough other evidence, perhaps I could help him convince the prosecutor that testifying posed too great a risk of further traumatizing the child. Stan explained that there was indeed other evidence. In fact, numerous types of physical evidence placed the perpetrator at the scene. Investigators had found the girl's mother's blood all over his clothes. Despite having fled the country after committing the crime, the man still had blood on his shoes when he was arrested. "So why does Sandy have to testify?" I asked. I was already starting to feel pulled to help this child. "This is part of what we're trying to figure out. We are hoping to have the case postponed until we can either get her testimony by closed-circuit TV or make sure she is ready to testify in court." He went on to describe the details of the murder, the girl's hospitalization due to injuries she'd received during the crime, and her subsequent foster care placements. As I listened, I debated whether or not to get involved. As usual, I was overextended and extremely busy. Plus, I'm uncomfortable in court, and I hate lawyers. But the more Stan talked, the more I couldn't believe what I was hearing. The people who were supposed to help this girl, from DCFS to the justice system, seemed clueless about the effects of trauma on children. I began to feel that she deserved to have at least one person in her life who might not be. "So let me go over this again," I said. "A 3-year-old girl witnesses her mother being raped and murdered. She has her own throat cut twice and is left for dead. She is alone with her dead mother's body for 11 hours in their apartment. Then she's taken to the hospital and has the wounds on her neck treated. In the hospital, the physicians recommend ongoing mental health evaluation and treatment. But after she's released, she's placed in a foster home as a ward of the state. Her CPS caseworker doesn't think she needs to see a mental health professional, so despite the doctor's recommendations, he doesn't get her any help. For 9 months, this child is moved from foster home to foster home with no counseling or psychiatric care whatsoever. and the details of the child's experiences are never shared with the foster families because she is in hiding. Right?
Yeah, I guess all of that is true, he said,
hearing the unmistakable frustration in my voice and how terrible it all sounded when I described the situation so bluntly. And now, 10 days before a murder trial is scheduled to start, you become aware of the situation?
Right, he admitted, sheepish now.
When did your office get notified about this girl? I demanded.
Actually, we opened the case right after this happened.
No one in your office thought to ensure that she had some mental health support?
We tend to review cases when they come up for their hearings. We have hundreds of cases apiece.
I wasn't surprised. The public systems working with high-risk families and children are overwhelmed. Oddly enough, during my years of clinical training in child mental health, I had little introduction to the child protective system or to the special education and juvenile justice systems, despite the fact that more than 30% of the children coming to our clinics were in one or more of these systems. The compartmentalization of services, training, and points of view was staggering, and I was learning very destructive for children. When and where can I see her? I asked. I couldn't help myself. I agreed to meet Sandy in an office at the court the next day. I was somewhat surprised that Stan had called me for help. Earlier that year, he had sent me a cease and desist letter. In 4 long paragraphs, I was told that I must immediately provide justification for the use of a medication called clonidine to control children at a residential treatment center where I consulted. I provided the psychiatric services for the children at the center. The letter said that if I could not explain what I was up to, I must immediately stop this experimental treatment. It was signed by Stan Walker in his official capacity as attorney with the Public Guardian. After receiving Stan's letter, I contacted him to explain why I was using this medication and why I believed it would be a mistake to stop. The children at this residential center were among the state's most difficult cases. More than 100 boys had been placed in this program after failing in foster homes due to severe behavioral and psychiatric problems. Although the facility accepted boys from 7 to 17, the average child in the facility was a 10-year-old who had lived in 10 prior homes, meaning that for most of them, no fewer than 10 parent substitutes had found them unmanageable. Easy to stir up and overwhelm, but very difficult to calm down. These children had been a problem for every caregiver, therapist, and teacher they had encountered. Ultimately, they had been kicked out of foster homes, child care settings, schools, and sometimes even therapy. The final stop was this center. After reviewing the records of some 200 boys who were then living at the center or who had been there in the past, I found that every single one of these boys, without exception, had experienced severe trauma or abuse. The vast majority had had at least 6 major traumatic experiences. All of these children had been born into and raised with chaos, threat, and trauma. They were incubated in terror. All of them had been evaluated multiple times both prior to and during their stay at the center. Each had been given dozens of different DSM diagnostic labels, primarily attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, and conduct disorder, just like Tina. But shockingly, very few of these children were viewed as traumatized or stressed. Their trauma wasn't deemed relevant to diagnosis, much like in Tina's case. Despite lengthy histories of domestic violence, repeatedly interrupted familial relationships, often including the loss of parents to violent death or disease, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and other overwhelmingly distressing events, few had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. PTSD did not even make it into the differential diagnosis, a list included in the case report of possible alternative diagnoses
with similar symptoms that each clinician considers, then rules out. Post-traumatic stress disorder was a relatively new concept at the time, having been introduced into the DSM diagnostic system in 1980 to describe a syndrome found in Vietnam veterans who, upon returning from their tours of duty, often experienced anxiety, sleep problems, and intrusive and disturbing flashback memories of events that took place during the war. They were frequently jumpy, and some responded aggressively to even the most minor signals of threat. Many had terrifying nightmares and reacted to loud noises as though they were gunshots and they were still back in the jungles of Southeast Asia. During my general psychiatry training, I had worked with vets who suffered from PTSD. Many psychiatrists were, even then, beginning to recognize its prevalence in adults who suffered other kinds of traumatic experiences, like rape and natural disasters. What struck me especially was that, although the experiences that had scarred adults with PTSD were often relatively brief, usually lasting for a few hours at most, their impact could still be seen in their behavior years, even decades later. It reminded me of what Seymour Levine had found in those rat pups, where a few minutes of stress could change the brain for life. How much more powerful, I thought, must the impact of a genuinely traumatic experience be for a child? Later, as a general resident in psychiatry, I studied aspects of the stress response systems in vets with PTSD. I and other researchers found that these veterans' stress response systems were overreactive, what scientists call sensitized. This meant that when they were exposed to minor stressors, their systems reacted as though they were facing great threat. In some cases, the brain systems associated with the stress response had become so active that they eventually burnt out and lost their ability to regulate the other functions they would normally mediate. As a result, the brain's capacity to regulate mood, social interactions, and abstract cognition was also compromised. At the time I was working with the boys at the center, I was continuing to study the development of the stress-related neurotransmitter systems in the lab. I was looking not only at adrenaline and noradrenaline now, but exploring other related systems as well, those using serotonin, dopamine, and the endogenous opioids, which are known as enkephalins and endorphins. Serotonin is probably best known as the site of action for antidepressant medications like Prozac and Zoloft. Dopamine is known as a chemical involved with pleasure and motivation involved in the high from drugs like cocaine and amphetamine. Endogenous opioids are the brain's natural painkillers and are affected by heroin, morphine, and similar drugs. All of these chemicals play important roles in the response to stress, with adrenaline and noradrenaline preparing the body for fight or flight, and dopamine providing a sense of competence and power to achieve one's goals. Serotonin's actions are less easy to characterize, but the opioids are known to soothe, relax, and reduce any pain that may be involved in responding to stress and threat. After I recognized that Tina's attention and impulsivity-related symptoms were linked to a hyper-aroused stress system, I had begun to think that medications that calm the stress system might help others like her. Clonidine, an old and generally safe medication, had long been used to treat people whose blood pressure was usually normal, but skyrocketed into hypertension when they were under stress. Clonidine helped quiet this reactivity down. A preliminary study using this medication had shown that it also helped decrease PTSD-related hyperarousal symptoms in adult combat veterans. Knowing that the physical symptoms many of the boys at the residential treatment center exhibited were consistent with an overactive and overly reactive stress system, I decided to try clonidine on them with their guardian's permission. And for many, it worked. Within a few weeks of beginning to take the medication, the boys' resting heart rates had normalized, and their sleep improved. Their attention became more focused, and their impulsivity was reduced.
Even better, the boys' grades began to improve, as did their social interactions with each other. To me, of course, this was no surprise. By reducing the overactivity in their stress systems, the medication enabled the boys to be less distracted by signals of threat. This helped them become more attentive to both academic material and ordinary social cues, allowing them to improve their schoolwork and interpersonal skills. I'd explained all of this to Stan Walker after I'd gotten his letter. To my surprise, he withdrew his objections and asked me to send him some more information about trauma and children. Unfortunately, as I informed him, there was not much written on the topic at the time. I sent him some of these early reports and some writing I had done myself. Until this call, I had not heard back from him. The next day, as I prepared to meet Sandy, I tried to imagine the crime she'd witnessed from her perspective. 9 months earlier, she had been found covered in blood, lying over her murdered mother's naked body, whimpering incoherently. At the time, she was not yet 4. How could she go on, day after day, with those images in her mind? How could I possibly prepare her for testimony and the confrontation of cross-examination, a threatening experience even for adults? What would she be like? I also wondered how she had survived psychologically. How could her mind protect her from these traumatic experiences? And how could any reasonable person, let alone someone trained to deal with troubled children, not realize that she needed help after what she'd been through? Unfortunately, the prevailing view of children and trauma at the time, one that persists to a large degree to this day, is that children are resilient. I recall visiting the scene of her murder around this time with a colleague who had started a trauma response team to help first responders to crime and accident scenes. Police, paramedics, and firefighters often see terrible panoramas of death, mutilation, and devastation. And this, of course, can take an awful toll. My colleague was justifiably proud of the services he had put into place to help these professionals. As we walked through the house where the victim's blood still soaked the couch and splattered the walls, I saw 3 young children standing like zombies in the corner. "What about the children?" I asked, as I nodded my head toward the 3 blood-speckled witnesses. He glanced at them, thought for a moment, and replied, "Children are resilient. They will be fine." Still young and respectful of my elders, I nodded my head as if to acknowledge his wisdom, but inside I was screaming. If anything, children are more vulnerable to trauma than adults. I knew this from Seymour Levine's work and the work of dozens of others by then. Resilient children are made, not born. The developing brain is most malleable and most sensitive to experience, both good and bad, early in life. This is why we so easily and rapidly learn language, social nuance, motor skills, and dozens of other things in childhood, and why we speak of formative experiences. Children become resilient as a result of the patterns of stress and of nurturing that they experience early on in life, as we shall see in greater detail later in this book. Consequently, we are also rapidly and easily transformed by trauma when we are young, though its effects may not always be visible to the untrained eye. When you know what trauma can do to children, sadly, you begin to see its aftermath everywhere. At that time, my laboratory was studying neurobiological mechanisms, which I knew were related to resilience and vulnerability to stress. We were examining a curious but very important effect of drugs that stimulate the systems I'd been studying in the brain. These effects are called sensitization and tolerance, and they have profound implications for understanding the human mind and its reaction to trauma. In sensitization, a pattern of stimulus leads to increased sensitivity to future similar stimulus. This is what is seen in the Vietnam veterans and the rats that were genetically oversensitive to stress, or became that way because of early exposure to it. When the brain becomes sensitized, even small stressors can provoke large responses. Tolerance, on the contrary, mutes one's response to an experience over time. Both factors are important for the functioning of memory. If we didn't get tolerant to familiar experiences, they would always appear new and potentially overwhelming. The brain would probably run out of storage capacity, like an old computer. Similarly, if we didn't become increasingly sensitive to certain things, we would not be able to improve how we respond to them. Curiously, both effects can be achieved with the same amount of the same drug, but you get completely opposite results if the pattern of drug use is different. For example, if a rat or a human is given small, frequent doses of drugs like cocaine or heroin that act on the dopamine and opioid systems, the drugs lose their strength. That is part of what happens during addiction. The addict becomes tolerant, and so more of the drug is needed to achieve the same high. In contrast, if you give an animal the exact same daily quantity of drug, but in large, infrequent doses, the drug actually gains strength. In 2 weeks, a dose that caused a mild reaction on day one can actually cause a profound and prolonged overreaction on day 14. Sensitization to a drug, in some cases, can lead to seizures and even death, a phenomenon that may be responsible for some otherwise inexplicable drug overdoses. Sadly for addicts, their drug craving tends to produce patterns of use that cause tolerance, not sensitization to the high that they desire, while simultaneously producing sensitization to certain undesirable effects, like the paranoia associated with cocaine use. More importantly, for our purposes, resilience or vulnerability to stress depend upon a person's neural system's tolerance or sensitization following earlier experience. These effects can also help further explain the difference between stress and trauma, which is important to understand as we consider children like Tina and Sandy. For example, use it or lose it is something we hear at the gym with good reason. Inactive muscle gets weak, while active muscle gets stronger. This principle is referred to as use dependence. Similarly, the more a system in the brain is activated, the more that system will build or maintain synaptic connections. The changes, memory of sorts, in muscle occur because patterned, repetitive activity sends a signal to muscle cells that you will be working at this level, so they make the molecular changes required to do that work easily. In order to change the muscle, however, the repetitions must be patterned. Curling 25 pounds 30 times in 3 closely timed sets of 10 curls leads to stronger muscle. If you curl 25 pounds 30 times at random intervals during the day, however, the signal to the muscle is inconsistent, chaotic, and insufficient to cause the muscle cells to become stronger. Without the pattern, the very same repetitions and very same total weight will produce a far less effective result. To create an effective memory and increase strength, experience has to be patterned and repetitive. And so it is with neurons, neural systems, and the brain. Patterns of experience matter. On a cell-by-cell basis, no other tissue is more suited to change in response to patterned repetitive signals. Indeed, neurons are designed to do just that. It is their molecular gift that allows memory. It produces the synaptic connections that allow us to eat, type, make love, play basketball, and do everything else a human being is capable of doing. It is these intricate webs of interconnection that make the brain work. By forcing either your muscles or your brain to work, however, you do stress them. Biological systems exist in balance. In order to function, they have to stay within a certain limited range appropriate to their current activity, and it is the brain that is charged with maintaining this essential equilibrium. The actual experience is a stressor. The impact on the system is stress. And so if you get dehydrated during exercise, for example, that stress will make you thirsty, because your brain is trying to drive you to replace the needed fluids. Similarly, when a child learns a new vocabulary word, there is a tiny stress applied to the cortex, which requires repetitive stimulation to create accurate recall. Without the stress, the system would know there is something new to attend to. In other words, stress is not always bad. Indeed, if moderate, predictable, and patterned, it is stress that makes a system stronger and more functionally capable. Hence, the stronger muscle in the present is the one that has endured moderate stress in the past. And the same is true for the brain's stress response systems. Through moderate, predictable challenges, our stress response systems are activated moderately. This makes for a resilient, flexible stress response capacity. The stronger stress response system in the present is the one that has had moderate pattern stress in the past. However, this is not the whole story. If you try to bench press 200 pounds on your first trip to the gym, if you do manage to lift the weight at all, you're not likely to build muscle, but tear it and hurt yourself. The pattern and intensity of experience matter. If a system is overloaded, worked beyond capacity, the result can be profound deterioration, disorganization, and dysfunction, whether you are overworking your back muscles at the gym or your brain's stress networks when confronted with traumatic stress. This also means that as a result of the strengthening effect of previous moderate and patterned experience, what may be traumatically stressful for one person may be trivial for another. Just as a bodybuilder can carry weights that untrained people cannot even move, so too can some brains deal with traumatic events that would cripple others. The context, timing, and response of others matters profoundly. The death of a parent is far more traumatic for the 2-year-old child of a single mother than it is for a 50-year-old married man with children of his own. In Tina's case, and that of the boys at the center, their experience of stress was far beyond their young system's capacities to carry it. Rather than moderate, predictable, and strengthening activation of their stress systems, they had suffered unpredictable, prolonged, and extreme experiences that had marked their young lives profoundly. I couldn't see any way that this would not be true for Sandy as well. Before I met her, I tried to get as much background and history on Sandy as I could. I talked with her current foster family, her new caseworker, and ultimately with members of her extended family. I learned that she had profound sleep problems and was pervasively anxious. I was told that she had an increased startle response. Just like the traumatized Vietnam vets I'd worked with, she would jump at the slightest unexpected noise. She also had episodic periods of daydreaming, during which it was extremely difficult to get her to snap out of it. A doctor who saw her without knowing her history might have diagnosed her with the absence or petit mal form of epilepsy. She was that hard to reach during these episodes. I also learned that Sandy sometimes had aggressive, tantrum-like outbursts. Her foster family couldn't find any pattern to these behaviors, couldn't pinpoint what set them off. But they did report another set of odd behaviors. Sandy didn't want to use silverware. Unsurprisingly, she was especially afraid of knives, but she also refused to drink milk or even look at milk bottles. When the doorbell rang, she would hide like a skittish cat, sometimes so effectively that it took 20 minutes for her foster parents to find her. She could also be found on occasion hiding beneath a bed, behind a couch, in a cabinet under the kitchen sink, rocking and crying. So much for resilience. Sandy's startle reaction alone told me that her sense response systems had become sensitized. Testifying would immerse her in painful reminders of that terrible night. I had to get some sense of whether or not she could tolerate it. Though I didn't want to, at some point in my initial visit, I was going to have to probe her memory a little to see how she would react. But I comforted myself with the knowledge that a little pain now could help protect her from a lot of pain later, and might even help her begin the healing process. I first met Sandy in a small room housed in a typical, sterile government building. It had been set up to be child-friendly, with some child-sized furniture, toys, crayons, coloring books, and paper. A few cartoon figures had been painted on the walls, but system still screamed out from the tile floors and cinder block construction. When I walked in, Sandy was sitting on the floor with some dolls around her. She was coloring. What first struck me, as it had when I first met Tina, was how small she was. I guess she stood a bit less than 4 feet tall. She had huge, liquid brown eyes and long, thick, curly brown hair. On her neck were visible scars on both sides, from her ears to the middle of her throat. But they were much less noticeable than I had imagined they might be. The plastic surgeons had done a good job. As I walked in with Stan, she stopped everything and stared at me, frozen. Stan introduced me. "Sandy, this is the doctor I told you about. He is going to talk with you, okay?" he said anxiously. She didn't move, not 1 millimeter. There was no change in her wary expression. In response, Stan looked at me and back at her, gave a big smile, and said in his best cheerful kindergarten teacher voice, "Okay, good. Well, I will leave you two together." As he walked out, I looked at him like he was nuts, surprised by how he dismissed Sandy's lack of response to his question. When I looked back at Sandy, her face wore the same expression that mine did. I shook my head, shrugged my shoulders, and gave a little smile, as if in a mirror, Sandy did the same. Aha! A connection. This was a good start, I thought. Don't let it slip away. I knew if I walked toward this tiny girl, I'm pretty big, her sensitized alarm response would go crazy. Her surroundings were already unfamiliar enough. New adults, new place, new situation. I needed her to stay as calm as possible. "I want to color some, too," I said, without looking at her. I wanted to be as predictable as possible and let her know what I was going to do step by step. No sudden moves. "Make yourself smaller," I thought. "Get on the floor. Don't look at her. Don't face her. Use slow, deliberate movements as you color." I sat down on the floor a few feet away. I tried to make my voice as soothing and calm as possible. "I really like red. This should be a red car," I said, pointing at a picture in my coloring book. Sandy studied my face, my hands, and my slow movements. She was only partly attentive to my words. This little girl was justifiably suspicious. For a long time, I colored alone, chattering about my choices of colors, being as casual and friendly as possible without being overly bright, as Stan had been when he tried to mask his anxiety. Eventually, Sandy broke the rhythm by moving a bit closer toward me and silently directing me to use a specific color. I complied. Once she came over to me, I stopped talking. For many minutes more, we colored together in silence. I had yet to ask her about what had happened, but I could sense that she knew that was why I was there, and that she knew that I knew she knew. All of the adults in her new life had sooner or later, in some way, returned her to that night. "What happened to your neck?" I asked, pointing to her 2 scars. She acted as if she did not hear me. She did not change her expression. She did not change the pace of her coloring. I repeated the question. Now she froze. Coloring stopped. Her eyes stared off into space, unblinking. I asked again. She took her crayon and scribbled over her well-formed, disciplined picture, but gave no response. Again I asked. I hated this. I knew I was pushing her toward her painful memories. Sandy stood up, grabbed a stuffed rabbit, held it by the ears, and slashed at the neck of the animal with the crayon. As she slashed, she repeated, "It's for your own good, dude," over and over, a stuck recording. She threw the animal to the floor, ran to the radiator, and climbed up and jumped off again and again. She did not respond to my warnings to be careful. Worried that she would hurt herself, I rose and caught her on one of her jumps.
she melted into my arms. We sat together for a few more minutes. Her frenzied breathing slowed and then almost stopped. And then, in a slow, robotic monotone, she told me about that night. An acquaintance of her mother had come to their apartment. He had rung the doorbell, and her mother had let him in. Mama was yelling. The bad guy was hurting her, she said. I should have killed him. When I came out of my room, and Mama was asleep, then he cut me, she continued. He said, "It's for your own good, dude." The assailant had cut her throat twice. Sandy immediately collapsed. Later, she regained consciousness and attempted to wake up her mother. She took milk from the refrigerator and gagged when she tried to drink some. It oozed through the slit in her throat. She tried to give some to her mother, but she was not thirsty, Sandy told me. Sandy wandered that apartment for 11 hours before anyone came. A relative, worried that Sandy's mother had not answered the phone, had dropped by and discovered the horrifying crime scene. By the end of that interview, I was certain that testifying would be devastating for Sandy. She needed help, and if she did have to testify, more time to prepare. Stan would work successfully, as it turned out, to postpone the trial. "Could you do the therapy?" he asked me. "Of course. I couldn't say no." The images of Sandy burned into my mind during that interview were staggering. A 3-year-old child, her throat cut, weeping, trying to comfort and also seeking comfort from her naked mother's hog-tied, bloody, and ultimately cold body. How helpless, confused, and terrified she must have felt. Her symptoms, her absences, her avoidant responses to my questions, her hiding, her specific fears, were defenses constructed by her brain to keep the trauma at bay. Understanding those defenses would be critical to helping her and other children like her. Even in utero and after birth, for every moment of every day, our brain is processing the non-stop set of incoming signals from our senses. Sight, sound, touch, smell, taste. All of the raw sensory data that will result in these sensations enter the lower parts of the brain and begin a multi-stage process of being categorized, compared to previously stored patterns, and ultimately, if necessary, acted upon. In many cases, the pattern of incoming signals is so repetitive, so familiar, so safe, and the memory template that this pattern matches is so deeply ingrained that your brain essentially ignores them. This is a form of tolerance called habituation. We ignore familiar patterns in ordinary contexts, so much so that we forget large portions of our days, which are spent doing routine things like brushing our teeth or getting dressed. We'll remember if a familiar pattern occurs out of context, however. For example, you might be on a camping trip, brushing your teeth as the sun comes up. The beauty of the moment is so powerful that you will remember this one time as unique. Emotions are powerful markers of context. The pleasure and joy of the sunrise in this instance is unusual in the brushing teeth memory template, so it makes it more vivid and memorable. Similarly, if you happen to be brushing your teeth when an earthquake destroys your home, those events may become forever connected in your mind and recalled together. Negative emotions often make things even more memorable than positive ones, because recalling things that are threatening and avoiding those situations in the future, if possible, is often critical to survival. A mouse that didn't learn to avoid the scent of cats after one bad experience, for example, would not be a mouse likely to produce many offspring. As a result, however, such associations can become the source of trauma-related symptoms. For an earthquake survivor who was brushing her teeth when the house collapsed around her, simply seeing a toothbrush might be enough to provoke a full-fledged fear response. In Sandy's case, milk, once associated with nurturing and nutrition, now became the stuff that spilled from her throat, that her mother refused as she lay dead.
Silverware was now no longer something used to eat your food, but rather something that killed and maimed and horrified. And doorbells? Well, that was what had started the whole thing. The ringing of the doorbell had announced the arrival of the killer. For her, these mundane and ordinary things had become evocative cues that kept her in a state of continual fear. This, of course, confused her foster parents and her teachers, who didn't know the details of what had happened to her, and therefore often couldn't recognize what might be prompting her strange behavior. They couldn't understand why she would be so sweet one moment, and then impulsive, defiant, and aggressive the next. The outburst seemed disconnected from any event or interaction that the adults could identify. But both the seeming unpredictability and the nature of her behaviors made complete sense. Her brain was trying to protect her based upon what it had previously learned about the world. The brain is always comparing current incoming patterns with previously stored templates and associations. This matching process takes place initially in the lowest, simplest parts of the brain, where, as you may recall, the neural systems involved in responding to threat originate. As the information moves upward from the first stage of processing, the brain has opportunities to take a second look at the data for more complex consideration and integration. But at first, all it wants to know is, does this incoming data potentially suggest danger? If the experience is familiar and known as safe, the brain's stress system will not be activated. However, if the incoming information is initially unfamiliar, new, or strange, the brain instantly begins a stress response. How extensively these stress systems are activated is related to how threatening the situation appears. It's important to understand that our default is set at suspicion, not acceptance. At a minimum, when faced with a new and unknown pattern of activity, we become more alert. The brain's goal at this point is to get more information, to examine the situation, and determine just how dangerous it might be. Since humans have always been the deadliest animal encountered by other humans, we closely monitor nonverbal signals of human menace, such as tone of voice, facial expression, and body language. Upon further evaluation, our brain may recognize that the new pattern of activation has been caused by something familiar, but out of context. For example, if you are in the library reading and someone drops a heavy book on a table, the loud noise will immediately make you stop reading. You will activate your arousal response, focus on the source of the noise, categorize it as a safe, familiar accident, perhaps annoying, but nothing to worry about. If, on the other hand, you hear a loud noise in the library, turn and discover that other people around you seem alarmed, then look up and see a man with a gun. Your brain would move from arousal to alarm, and probably then into full-blown fear. If in a few minutes you learn that this was a bad student prank, your brain would slowly move back down this arousal continuum toward a state of calm. The fear response is graded, calibrated by the brain's perceived level of threat. As you become increasingly frightened, the threat systems in your brain continue to integrate incoming information and orchestrate a total body response aimed at keeping you alive. To that end, an impressive set of interacting neural and hormonal systems work together to make sure your brain and the rest of your body do the right things. First, your brain makes you stop thinking about irrelevant things, by shutting down the chatter of the frontal cortex. Then it focuses on cues from others around you to help you determine who might protect or threaten you by letting the limbic system's social cue reading systems take over. Your heart rate increases to get blood to your muscles in case you need to fight or flee. Your muscle tone also increases and sensations like hunger are put aside. In thousands of different ways, your brain prepares to protect you. When we are calm, it is easy to live in our cortex, using the highest capacities of our brains to contemplate abstractions, make plans, dream of the future, read. But if something attracts our attention and intrudes on our thoughts, we become more vigilant and concrete, shifting the balance of our brain activity to subcortical areas to heighten our senses in order to detect threats. As we move up the arousal continuum toward fear, then, we necessarily rely on lower and faster brain regions. In complete panic, for example, our responses are reflexive and under virtually no conscious control. Fear quite literally makes us dumber, a property that allows faster reactions in short periods of time and helps immediate survival. But fear can become maladaptive if it is sustained. The threat system becomes sensitized to keep us in this state constantly. This hyper-arousal response accounted for many of Sandy's symptoms. But not all of them. The brain doesn't have just one set of adaptations for threat. In the situation Sandy faced, she was so small and so powerless, and the threat she experienced so overwhelming, that she was unable to fight or flee. If her brain had responded by raising her heart rate and preparing her muscles for action, that would only have made her more likely to bleed to death when she was injured. Amazingly, our brains have a set of adaptations for these kinds of situations as well, which accounts for another important set of trauma-related symptoms known as dissociative responses. Dissociation is a very primitive reaction. The earliest life forms, and the youngest members of higher species, can rarely escape dire situations under their own steam. Their only possible response to being attacked or hurt, then, is essentially to curl up, to make themselves as small as possible, to cry for help and hope for a miracle. This response appears to be driven by the most primitive brain systems, located in the brain stem and immediately surrounding it. For infants and young children, incapable of or ineffective at fighting or fleeing, a dissociative response to extreme stressors is common. It is also more common in females than males, and, if prolonged, dissociation is connected with increased odds for post-traumatic stress symptoms. During dissociation, the brain prepares the body for injury. Blood is shunted away from the limbs, and the heart rate slows to reduce blood loss from wounds. A flood of endogenous opioids, the brain's natural heroin-like substances, is released, killing pain, producing calm and a sense of psychological distance from what has